And George, the other thing that you could do that would help me and maybe some others is to repeat people's questions.
Okay.
Because then it'll pick that up for sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Richard. Can we bow in? Is everybody comfortable with bowing? Do we need any discussion about the significance or anything?
No, as long as I don't have to bend too far.
No, just a simple nod of the head is adequate. And then let's go around and just say your name. I'm George.
I'm Lee.
Tim.
Constance.
Eric.
Carol.
Barbara.
Dan.
Susan.
Noemi.
Kristen.
Richard.
Bill.
Tim.
David. Noemi, where do I know you from?
From here, from Shambhala Center in Boulder.
Okay. Did you do the Dotson?
No.
Okay.
But we have shared talks.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you look familiar. So, well, thanks for coming, everyone. It's great to see you. So, this is recording. And Melissa asked people to give talks. And in a moment of complete irrationality, I said that I would. So, here I am. And there were no guidelines about what it should be about, so I felt I had free rein. I could talk about anything I wanted to talk about, and which really, when you're talking about the Buddha Dharma or Shambhala Dharma or whatever, I mean, there is like a bazillion things you could talk about. I mean, for Buddhism is so simple. In one sense, I mean, the historical Buddha, Gautama Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha that was talked about last week, he said, I teach one thing, suffering and its cessation. So, it seems pretty simple. but because there's a 2,500 year history of it and many teachers teaching, and the Buddha giving many sutras, which were his talks, and then there were commentaries on the sutras, which are called shastras, and then commentaries on the commentaries and explications of all kinds of things. That when you get involved in this path, if you're interested in study, you will be busy for the rest of your life. That's what draws you, and it kind of does draw me, actually. So anyway, I had all these things to talk about, and I started casting about, and someone suggested, well, why don't we talk about joy? I won't mention any names, he said that. And because, you know, in Buddhism, there's so much emphasis on suffering, and with good reason, because there is a lot of it to deal with. And we don't talk much about joy. So, I didn't come prepared to talk about joy tonight, but we may talk about it at the end. And the way I was conceptualizing this evening was that I would talk about a topic, and I picked intention as the topic, in hopes that everybody would get engaged in this. And, you know, it'd be, I would say some things to give some shape to the topic, and maybe some orientation, but then it's something that we all have knowledge of. We all have something to say about intention. And when I started thinking about intention, I realized that it permeates everything we do. Every act that we make, every action we take is based on intention. I intend to pick up my mug. I intend to put it down. I intend to go to the talk. I intend to go home. So there's all these mundane intentions. And since it's the new year, we make New Year's resolutions, so we have a bunch of new intentions, maybe. I'm going to practice more this year, or I'm going to be nicer to my friends, or I'm going to be less of a jerk, or whatever your resolution is. But in the context of the Dharma, it's also a very big deal. Intention is very important. And in fact, it's the second point of the Eightfold Path. So just to review the Eightfold Path, see if I can do this. Right view, right intention, right speech, right discipline, right livelihood, right effort, right meditation, and right samadhi. And Trungpa Rinpoche, he's spoken about that. He talks about the Eightfold Path in this book, which I highly recommend people read, The Myth of Freedom. He talks about it elsewhere, and he talks about it as perfect. Perfect view, perfect intention, perfect so forth. So intention forms a very important part of the whole path. In common parlance, Webster's says defines it as determination and firm direction. So it's like really setting a course of action and really pursuing it. Is you have this intention to follow through. And one of the reasons I thought we'd talk about intention is because when I was here last week, I was talking to some people to find out why you come here. You know, so if you're new, we'd like to hear, you know, what's your intention? You know, or not that it's a commitment or anything, but just like, what's your interest? What drew you here? I was thinking intention is also aspiration or orientation, how you want to orient your life. And people who have been coming here for a while, we'd like to hear your intention too, because it will inspire other people. You know, what something brought you here and something keeps you coming back. So what's that? You know, that could be inspiring for someone to hear. Or maybe not. I don't know. But I know that people come here for a variety of reasons. Curiosity, you know, people have heard about Buddhism. Well, what's that? It might be interesting to check out. Let's see what it is. Meditation, I thought about doing that for years. Maybe I'll give that a shot. I'm stressed out. I hear that this can help me de-stress, maybe give me a little more focus, help me cope with my job or my relationships or whatever. What were some of the other things? Calling. You know, that sometimes there's a calling to do something. So the intention is to follow that calling, you know. So I know that there are a lot of intentions, probably about 16 of them in here. So we can talk about intention. There's a book called The Art and Science of Mindfulness, big, thick book. And I think it's written for therapists, but I only read one article from it for Dale Azrael's class at Naropa. And intention is one of the three core parts of the model of mindfulness. There's intention, attention, and attitude. And Jack Kornfield says intention, in terms of therapy or in terms of your Dharma practice, intention is a direction. It's not a destination. It's just aiming somewhere, and it's not, we're not quite sure where it's going. And if we follow in an intention, it clarifies itself. The more we follow it, the more specific we get about what our true intention is. I mean, we may come here because we're feeling stressed out, and maybe start to feel a little bit less stressed out. And because you're pursuing this path of meditation, you start to make discoveries about yourself. And you start to see some of your brilliance, or some of your hang-up, or some of where you pull back, or you are engaged and interested. So the original intention was, I'm coming here to get kind of like focused and de-stressed, and they go, there's something else going on here. So then our intention becomes, well, I'd like to explore this. This looks interesting. So there's this evolution of intention. And the kind of the ultimate intention of this whole path, I mean, we're working on ourselves. We get some clarity, we get some stability, we start to feel maybe a little healthier, a little more engaged. And then we think, well, I'd like to work with other people. I'd like to take this into the world somehow. You know, so there's this urge to work with others, which is the beginning of compassion. And then developing that compassion becomes more of an intention. How do I develop this? You know, how do I be helpful but not lay my trip on somebody? You know, how can I listen to other people as much as listen to myself? So, John Kabat-Zinn, do you know who John Kabat-Zinn is? He is a pioneer in the field of mindfulness in the sense of bringing mindfulness into the forefront of our culture. He's a longtime meditator, Vipassana practitioner, some Zen. He's also was a yoga practitioner. He's also a PhD in molecular biology. And he started a mindfulness-based stress reduction program at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Anyway, what he said about intention and in terms of practice, I'm going to read this quote. He said, "Your intentions set the stage for what is possible. They remind you from moment to moment of why you're practicing in the first place. I used to think that meditation was so powerful that as long as you did it at all, you would see growth and change. But time has taught me that some kind of personal vision is also necessary." So it's good to reflect on your vision for your life, your vision for your practice. It will propel you forward and keep you focused on something beyond your limitation, beyond your hesitation, you know, beyond your little concern about yourself. There's something else happening. And when you catch that whiff of something bigger, it starts to draw you forward. At least that's been kind of my experience. So it's not only important to be clear about your intention, but to be clear about what right intention is. Is it, you know, our ultimate intention is to be hopefully kind and helpful, or at least not harmful. We could also have the intention of doing harm, but right intention has a more noble point of view than that. We don't want to make a mess of ourselves or a mess of our life. So, I studied for about 10 years with a teacher named Trungpa Rinpoche. Trungpa Rinpoche he's still living. He's in his 80s, and he's a Dharma brother of Trungpa Rinpoche. They both escaped Tibet at the same time, 1959, fleeing from the communist Chinese, and took some initiations together and studied with some of the same teachers and so forth. He said that every time you sit down to practice, you should have your intention. You know, why are you doing this? You can just take a moment to ask yourself that. And it doesn't have to be some heavy-handed religious thing, and you don't have to do it every time you sit down, but he recommends having that sense of intention. When you sit down, why am I sitting down? Or what do I want to accomplish? It could be as simple as my intention is to go to my meditation cushion and sit for 5 minutes. That's my intention. Or I'm going to make an effort to be with every breath for the first 10 breaths. Whatever, come hell or high water, I'm going to come back to the breath. It could be an intention as simple as that. Or it could be, I'm going to practice with my tendency toward anger today, or my resentment, or I'm going to try to work with my physical discomfort, or you name it. But have some reason why you're sitting there, and something that you direct your practice toward. My practice today is going to be to help me be a more thoughtful person. So, fill in the blank. So, those are my comments about intention to start with. And we could have more, but I'm curious what's happening with folks and what your intentions are, or what questions you have, or it could be anything. And if you're new, don't be shy. You say, "What are you people doing here?" You know, ask. You know, it's a friendly crowd, I believe. It's been my experience. So, anyway, I'm curious what people are thinking. Did I make any sense? I was hoping I would be coherent at least for 15 minutes or so. Whether I said anything helpful.
I have to say that when you started to talk about intention, I was thinking, oh, how nicely that fits in with the American way. You know, you get an idea what you're going to do, you get focused, you forge ahead. And really, for the past 5 years, I guess, I have been, I think, intentionless. So it's been a very odd.
Are you speaking
to like be in the society, and you know, some people would say, "What do you do?" And I don't know what to say, you know. I could make something up so it sounds like I'm doing something. That always seems to be very important. But I kind of let that go. And in the process, what I've been trying to let go of is what I used to do. You know, what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And try and find out kind of what's alive right now, you know. So so it seems like intention for me can be tricky in this culture because there's a lot of rah-rah about that. Mm. And letting myself be really uncomfortable because I don't have intention, to, at least the way I used to or something,
mm-hmm.
Is I can judge myself negatively about that. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
So, well, so what's wrong with being intentionless? I mean, maybe you're starting a revolution in America.
Yeah, really. Well, I know intellectually there's nothing wrong with it,
yeah.
But as a person who has been very intentioned mm-hmm. in the past and mm-hmm. somebody who still would like to be kind of a part of the world and, you know, in my way contribute, it's been rather confusing, actually.
Mm-hmm.
My upbringing has been... my upbringing has been I'm a North American person and, you know, I'm supposed to have a career or a job or, you know, have some clear-cut intention that I could actually describe to someone. And rather than say that I'm intentionless, I think what I would say is I don't know how to describe to you what my intentions are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been actually kind of trying to ride that wave a bit and not... and just see what that means for
mm-hmm.
me. Because it's different than how I used to live, so.
Well, it sounds okay. whose expectations are you living up to anyway?
Yeah, well, society, myself, you know.
Yourself.
The way yeah. that I see myself and how yeah. I present myself to the world and what I right. say that I'm doing has been very much about how I, you know, champion the folks that can't speak for themselves. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been doing that for so long. And mm-hmm. Now I'm sort of trying to champion me, whatever that means. I don't know what that means.
Well, that sounds like your intention, then.
Yeah, I guess, you know, so that really is the intention, is to
yeah.
stop that.
Mm-hmm. The intention is how can I just be true to myself
yeah.
and not live up to someone's expectations.
And particularly my own.
And the voices in my head that
yeah,
tell me
exactly.
I'm not good enough.
Yeah. Or you should be doing
it. Or you should, or yeah.
Why can't you?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot of those patterns in there. And... there's a core belief. Have you talked about core belief in here much or at all? Core belief is something that's in cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, you're working with your fundamental message about yourself or to yourself. And Joko Beck, whom I almost talked about tonight, extraordinary Zen teacher, Western. She died a few years ago, 90-some years old. Very sharp, penetrating teacher. Nailed you on the spot. I mean, I was around her. It was amazing. Talked to her on the phone a couple times, too. But anyway, she worked very much with core belief. And that was kind of like the goal of a lot of her practice sessions. She would hold Zen sessions. And it meant a lot about going into those dark places in yourself you don't want to go to and contact whatever that pain and suffering is in there. And as a result of doing that over and over again and looking and looking, your core belief came to the surface. And she said generally the core belief that most people have is I'm not good enough. I'm unacceptable as I am. I'm unlovable. I'm not okay. She said, almost across the board, everyone she works with has one of those. Usually, what, three or four. But I think we all resonate with that somewhat. I mean, I do. You know, when we're all alone and quiet, there's still, I'm not good enough. You know, there's something lacking. It's a very common, anybody else have that feeling?
Maybe you should ask if anybody doesn't have it.
Anybody? Anybody not have that feeling?
I don't think I feel that very often. Oh. Maybe like there's definitely times when I question like if I'm like doing well in this society and meeting up to those standards. But my intention was always to give thanks, and that's how I found Buddhism, because I I've enjoyed everything so much. Like, it's been such a great life, and I knew that I had to start somehow saying thank you for that, because I knew that wouldn't last forever, and I don't feel a lot of inadequacies or anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I've kind of thrived, and I know that that's a gift that doesn't last forever.
Yeah, so you're
my intention is to try to give back as much as I can because of that.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I think everyone definitely feels inadequate. There's times I do, for sure, but it's definitely not an overriding thing in my life.
Okay. Well, it's not necessarily overriding for people either. I mean, and I think it is something you kind of grow beyond sometimes. I mean, you do gain confidence in yourself and worldly knowledge, and you realize, well, I actually can navigate through this society and this world and be okay. But you're fortunate that it's, you know, that it's, you have another kind of attitude happening. But not always the case.
It's funny that you talk about giving thanks, because one of my main intentions for meditation is also gratitude, but it comes from a different place. I was drawn to meditation after having two very traumatic back surgeries. And a lot of pain, a lot of fear. I was walking with a walker for a little while. I didn't know if I'd ever walk properly again. And I came out of it, with some permanent things like nerve damage. And, you know, so I try to focus on the gratitude for the things that I have and what I can do instead of my limitations, what I can't do, because it's really easy to get sucked into the negative aspects of things. And so I try to focus on the good rather than the bad, and say thank you for what I do have rather than what I, what I don't.
Yeah.
And I had read a book that was given to me by a neighbor, by Pema Chodron, called The Places That Scare You.
Mm-hmm.
Very good book, and I credit that book for actually bringing me through a really, really rough time. And she talks in that about the, I think it's called Tonglen breathing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And compassion practice, and I started doing both of those things, and it really got me over the hump of the worst part of what I was experiencing. So, you were talking a little bit last week about joy, and you had thought that maybe you were going to talk about that, and I was thinking about that earlier today, and a lot of joy for me starts with gratitude.
I may get around to talking about joy before the night's over. We'll see. Because I was thinking about it while I was sitting up here, actually. Looking at what's not wrong is a very important practice. And that's one that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about quite a bit, actually. And I did a retreat with him years ago up at Winter Park, and it was a retreat for psychotherapists and social workers. And he said, you know, problem with most therapy is people go, what's wrong? You know, what's wrong? Where are things not right? You know, And it starts from that pathology model that there's a problem and we got to fix it, we got to get in there and work. And he says, what if you took the other approach and said, what's right with your life? You know, it's important to say to your clients once in a while, well, what's not wrong? Because they often will astound you. I worked as a psychotherapist for 27 years at the Mental Health Center in Boulder. And I worked with some pretty intense cases. People with schizophrenia, people with bipolar, people with serious depression and anxiety and, you know, life issues. And, of course, they would come in and sit down and, and I would say, let's just stop for a minute. I said, how are you right now? Oh, I'm fine. I mean, if you can, like, stop them, you know, and just brought them into the present moment, they went, oh, I'm okay. But, brother, you know, so it's interesting. And actually, they've done studies about people who are practicing mindfulness. And I can't cite you the studies. I've only heard these secondhand. But they found that when someone is focused on something that they're doing, and they're very present and they're very mindful, that they're happy. So it's like being in the present moment is what brings you to happiness or joy. Anyway, what else about intention? What keeps people coming back here? David?
Well, for me, it's that, you know, I came to believe that the path was a good one because of positive things that had happened to me from trying. Mm-hmm. You know. And so, you know, I keep coming back, hoping to get back to the level of practice that I once had, because I've been kind of detached lately. Because I just believe it's not just a good thing for me, but for everybody else around me too, because, you know, I mean, the more peaceful I am with myself, generally the more peaceful I am with everybody else too, so.
Well, you know, practice waxes and wanes. It's just, that's it.
Yeah, my experience is that the intention changes a lot. Before I started meditating, I knew that I read enough to realize that meditation, you know, you can get away from all this junk in the world. It was an escape. So my intention when I first came was to get out all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, it was wrong. So I think that basically, maybe you're. Attention gets honed over time, sort of aimed a little better, mm-hmm. more accurate. Mm-hmm. Because it's certainly, I think it initially was exceedingly selfish. You know, it was me. I wanted to fix or escape me from all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And then over time, there comes a realization that everybody is me, you know, that I have all these terrible things, you know, all this stuff, and then, you know, it's a realization that everybody's got their version of the same stuff. And so there's a little bit of, I guess that's where the compassion comes in. And so it's like what David said, that once you realize that this stuff, what we're doing, helps a lot. And maybe accepting who I am and even finding out who I am, that, and the realization that other people are in the same boat, that sort of changes. It changes the focus from me to us. You know, what do we do to help us? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's the honing of the intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point because, I mean, in my experience, it's like things, if I practice and so on, things get better, but not exactly in the way that I was imagining. You know, it's different. You know, and so that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
When you started to talk about intention, that was what I was conscious of, is that how it never seems to work out the way I intend. And yet it could be actually better than I intended in a weird way. Mm-hmm. So it's very confusing. Mm-hmm. I feel really enriched and privileged, you know, to have had the path that I've had. And I'm still messed up and all that, you know. But it has made things better in ways that I didn't expect.
Yeah. Well, when you open yourself up to practice, you're opening yourself up to surprise. I mean, you might expect to sit down. You've been depressed or you've had a horrible week or something bad is going on, and you sit down to practice thinking, well, I think I'll just have to tough this one out, you know? And you sit down, and all of a sudden everything opens up. You know, it's like, oh, there's a whole other world going on, you know? It's not all just about me and my problems. There's something else, which is hard to put our, I don't know, sometimes hard to put your finger on what that thing is. But, yeah.
I think one of the reasons I keep coming to practice and studying is to continue to find out more and more about truth. Mm-hmm. I think one of the amazing experiences that I've had through practice and study is how my view of the world and of everything in it has changed. And my beliefs, I don't even want to use that word, my understanding of what is really true is so different. I remember when my meditation teacher first told me there was no self. It's a terrible moment for me, because I had spent my career trying to help my students have self-esteem and self-respect. Did I waste my career? It took a long time for me to work with that. And things like that, over and over. Oh, this is not true. I believe this forever. I have to work with it again. It just is always something fresh.
I'm glad you mentioned practice and study, because I wanted to put a plug in for that. Sounds like people are studying, but it's really helpful to get your meditation instruction, learn the basics, and start to sit, and have some experience of what that is. I mean, you think that you're coming to study Buddhism, and what you end up studying is yourself. It's like, well, that's interesting. But that's what happens, right? maybe there is no such thing. There is no such thing as Buddhism. You know, it's just a technique, or it's just method. And that's the beauty of Buddhism and the path, is that over these 2,500 years, they've developed all these methods for dealing with all kinds of situations. They've got everything, you know, figured out, maybe. But you have to do your own figuring, but you can use those as tools. But it's important to, when you're practicing, to also study, to read texts. You know, find what appeals to you. Maybe it's Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings. Maybe it's Sakyam Rigpam Rinpoche's teachings. Maybe it's Pema Chodron or Thich Nhat Hanh or Joe Schmo, you know. But people who are actually working with themselves and working through confusion and have found something, I mean, it's very helpful. And studying the Eightfold Path, what's that? Or the Four Noble Truths. I was thinking that, I don't know how much this group does like systematic study. I mean, we don't have really the capacity or the time and space and stuff, but I moved to Boulder 40 years ago, this March. To study with Trungpa Rinpoche. And yeah, Boulder was just this hotbed of Dharma. I mean, Trungpa, and he had 1,000 students living in town, and you know, there were like seminars and talks and community talks and retreats and datsuns and seminaries, and I mean, and a book came out every, you know, the new book just came out, and we were so, and teachers coming through, you know, Zen teachers, and Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, and the Dalai Lama, and Kala Rinpoche. I mean, it was such a rich time. But there were all these classes. I mean, you started out square one, sit, basics of sitting, what's shamatha, what's vipassana, how do they work together, how does shamatha evolve into vipassana, what are the Four Noble Truths, what is the Nidana chain? What are the skandhas? What, you know, what are the two truths, relative and absolute? It was a very systematic building, and Trungpa Rinpoche was a master at that. I mean, he started very basic and just gradually built the whole thing up. The whole Hinayana path. Hinayana becomes Mahayana, Mahayana becomes Vajrayana, and then he introduced the Shambhala teachings. And yeah, there's such a wealth of stuff to study. Your practice will benefit from study, and your study will benefit from your practice, and it just keeps going, feeding on itself. A plug. And we have a library right here.
Yeah. It's getting close to 9 o'clock. So what I would suggest is we want you to come back and talk about joy whenever you're next time you can.
Well, okay.
Because that is a definitely...
I'll do my best. I mean, I had to rack my brain to come up with, you know. But, okay. Joy is actually... I think it's tied with cessation. So if we talk about the Four Noble Truths, it's like the cessation is that suffering can be conquered. You can actually be free of suffering. And what is more joyful than that? I mean, what's more joyful than you can actually work with your life? That none of the things that seem like overwhelming problems are really overwhelming problems. They're all workable. Wow. That is joy. Okay, shall we stop? Thanks for engaging.
We have a quick moment for announcements.
Oh.
And I think that the major one is really the upcoming practices for inner peace weekend, Saturday, January 30th, that Carol, you want to talk about it?
Okay, sure.
In 2012, the Longmont Shambhala Meditation Group and the Prairie Mountain Zen Center, run by Cliff Clusen, who's the person who rents this spot and shares it with all of us, we invited as many meditation groups as we could find and other kinds of practitioners like Tai Chi and, I don't know, I can't remember.
Feldenkrais.
Anyway, Feldenkrais. So our goal was to support each other, to develop a community to support each other, and also to share our practices with the community. Because we found that there were very few people in Longmont who even knew about the